First, thank you for being here, and also thank you to Anne-Emmanuelle Byrne, who could not be with us today, and to Louise for organizing this panel. I'm eager to tell you a bit about my most recent work, but let me tell you a little bit more about what I have done in the past. In my previous work, I explored the centrality of yellow fever to the creation of a national system of public health in the United States. Public health issues in the United States, as many of you know, had been exclusively the domain of states. It's an issue of states' rights in the 19th century, rather than the federal government. But the pressures and conflicts between states faced in the 1905 epidemic of yellow fever, in particular between Louisiana and Mississippi, in regards to controlling the disease, underlined the need of a national system and contributed to an administrative shift to a more nationalized public health system. Now I continue to look at yellow fever, but I'm interested in medical understandings of the disease in the Caribbean region at a time of empire, before the discovery of the mosquito vector of transmission. I found that starting around the 1650s, when yellow fever becomes endemic in the region, we can see evidence of physicians from the French, British, and Spanish empires making medical observations about the behavior of the disease and making recommendations as to how Europeans, strangers to the Caribbean, should deal with the issue that they face as soon as they get to the region. And Veracruz is a great place to start looking at this, because it was a very important and continues to be a very important Caribbean port. Now, you might say this is a Gulf port, but in the world of colonial Latin America and in the world of Mexico and the Caribbean, Veracruz is a Caribbean port. It is the principal Atlantic port of the Viceroyalty of New Spain, and then later of the Mexican nation after independence in the 1820s. And you can see in this map how central it really is. And this is a map of the Manila galleon trade during the Spanish colonial times. When, as you can see, the Spanish Empire spans both oceans, from Manila, so the Spanish colony in the Philippines, all the way to Seville. And you would have silver from the mines in the Americas, from Potosí, from Taxco, from different parts of the Spanish Empire, shipped from Acapulco to Manila to be traded for silk and for china. That would then come back through the Americas and out Veracruz to the Spanish mainland. Holding Veracruz, therefore, for the Spanish, or conquering it for another power, was the key to getting into the Mexican mainland and controlling the wealth and power that could come with it. For that reason, Veracruz has been called a heroic city, and this is a Google Maps. When you go to Google Maps and you find Veracruz, it says Heroica Veracruz there on the right. It's definitely a heroic city. It's on the map, so it must be. It's still called that, as you can see. And it's heroic multiple times, more than three. But there's three instances of heroism that always are brought in by most people who talk about Veracruz as a heroic city. And these are instances where foreign navies seized the opportunity to conquer the city, only to be eventually kicked out. The first one that people refer to is in 1825. Mexico had been fighting for its independence for decades when the war ended in the early 1820s. The last Spanish troops remained garrisoned at the end of the war in the fort of San Juan de Ulúa in Veracruz, a fort that protected the city, only to be blockaded and forced to withdraw a few years later in 1825 by the newly formed Mexican Armada. The second example given of the heroism of Veracruz is the Pastry War in 1838. The first decades of independence in Mexico were tumultuous, politically unstable, and newly independent countries in the Americas during this time. Mexico was a place of revolution and political instability. And it turned out that the French government had loaned the Mexican government money so that it could fight against Texas declaring itself independent in 1835. And having lost that battle, it did not repay its debt. So when in 1838, French citizens who resided in Mexico appealed to their consul and their government because their property had been destroyed by a band of rebels, it was a pastry shop. The French government then used that as an excuse to intervene and try to get their payment back from the loan. The plan was that they would take the city of Veracruz and shut down Mexico's Atlantic trade, thereby forcing the Mexican nation to pay up. And it was a seizure of the port that lasted from November through March of 1838, and they're forced to withdraw without payment. And finally, in 1847, we have the third example that most people use as Veracruz being a heroic city, when it's again heroic when the U.S. invaded the city during the Mexican-American War. The battle for Veracruz is the first battle of the second front of that war, the first front being from the north. And this time, the U.S. took the city and was able to go on to Mexico City and force the Mexican government to agree to U.S. demands. So heroic, but they didn't really win the battle. But Veracruz is not only defended by brave men and women. It's also defended by yellow fever. Yellow fever was notoriously endemic in the city. And this disease was horrifying. It was the disease that caused panic in the 19th century. And the symptoms range from tropical fever symptoms of a fever and body aches, and the most severe cases were really dramatic. People described them as horrifying. People who were going to travel to the region of the Caribbean would fear the fact that the other symptoms would be the jaundice that gave the disease its name, yellow fever, but also internal organ failure, internal bleeding, and vomiting of coagulated blood, thereby the other name of the disease, the black vomit, or vomito negro, or vomito prieto. And it's in Veracruz because the particular mosquito that transmits disease likes clean reservoirs of water in cities. So it's endemic there at that time, even though they don't really know in the 19th century that it's a mosquito that transmits it. So if we look at these three instances of intervention mentioned before, these three times heroic moments, we can see how yellow fever played an important role in the success or failure of imperial incursions into the port. So here we have, again, back to 1825. The fort of San Juan de Ulua, you see that towards the middle of the slide, opposite the city of Veracruz. And it's an incredibly strong fort, very difficult to get to. It's surrounded by reefs and atolls, sandbars. There's only one way to get into the Bay of Veracruz, which is around the right side, to get to the village of Veracruz. So anyone trying to get to Veracruz was facing the guns, and the city was facing the guns as well. The war had ended in 1821. Mexicans were victorious. But the fort was this last stronghold where about 150 Spanish troops kind of stayed. In 1825, the garrison began bombarding the city of Veracruz across the bay. And Mexican President Guadalupe de Victoria organized an offensive to eliminate the enemy. And it's the first time he had to buy boats from the British so there could be a Mexican armada. The Spanish troops that were garrisoned in the fort of San Juan de Ulua were not just suffering from a lack of supplies once this Mexican armada blockaded the supplies coming from Havana, but they were also decimated by yellow fever, and there's multiple accounts of the sick in the fort and how devastating that was. And by November 25th, having gone through a terrible yellow fever season, had surrendered. When the French arrive to the port of Veracruz, in a shocking development to all assembled military, they're able to bombard the fort into submission. In this image depicts, in a very French heroic painting, the collapse of one of the towers of the fort of San Juan de Ulua. This is a battle where Mexican General Santa Anna loses his leg. If any of you are familiar with Mexican history, Santa Anna loses his leg fighting the French in Veracruz. But when the French are able to take the city, he retreats and he waits as the French soon begin to feel the devastating effects of fever. Every time an ultimatum was sent to Mexico City, it was returned without resolution, knowing that they would not be able to remain strong in the city. On the ships arriving in the region for the war to support the troops, fear of the fever was rampant as they approached the Caribbean region. Entire regiments died before even entering the waters of the bay. The French were forced to disembark troops on an island called Isla Sacrificios, and bury their dead. They just couldn't deal with it, and they disembarked on this island. It's really a sandbar. It's not much more than sand, but they found cemeteries of other empires that had dealt with the same issue. One observer aboard the ship noted, quote, that the squadron had three enemies to fight: the sea, the thirst, and yellow fever. The thing is that at the time of these wars, even though there was no knowledge of the inset vector of transmission, people knew how to avoid yellow fever. Residents and those familiar with Veracruz knew that the disease had a season where it was strongest, and that it was only in the city and coast. Once you got up, so you see this elevation, this is the road, the elevation of the road from Veracruz to Jalapa. So once you go into the Sierra Madre Mountains on the way to Jalapa, people observed no one would get sick with fever. Traders would often stay in Jalapa until news that their ship was ready arrived. Only then would they quickly make their way down to the port, board the ship, sail away. Visitors would arrive in the city and quickly head up the hills to Jalapa to escape the oppressive heat and pestilence. In the early 1800s, Alexander von Humboldt, and this is his illustration, had described the ways in which wealthy natives avoided the disease by spending the summer months in Jalapa. And he said, "The richest merchants of Veracruz have country houses at Jalapa, in which they enjoy a cool and agreeable retreat, while the coast is almost uninhabitable from the mosquitoes, the great heats, and the yellow fever." So this German explorer naturalist sent by the French to write these observations of the Americas and wrote down these observations that he had heard and these conversations that he had with his Mexican friends and published them in French, and they were later translated in very well circulated publications. Safety from the disease was reached when one passed this line of oaks that I have marked here on the road to Jalapa, a line that could be seen from the sea. And he observed, "As we ascend, nature appears gradually less animated, the beauty of the vegetable forms diminished, the shoots become less succulent, and the flowers less colored. The aspect of the Mexican oak quiets the alarms of travelers newly landed at Veracruz. Its presence demonstrates to him that he has left behind him the zone so justly derided by the people of the north, under which the yellow fever exercises its ravages in New Spain. This inferior limit of oaks warns the colonists who inhabit the central tableland how far he may descend towards the coast without dread of the mortal disease of the vomito." And others knew this as well. So this is not just Humboldt and the people in Veracruz telling him about this medical knowledge. There's a man by the name of William Bullock who travels through Mexico when it is transitioning from a Spanish colony to an independent country. And he references Humboldt, agrees that on the way to Veracruz, 4 leagues beyond Jalapa, the suffocating heat commences, the oak tree is no longer to be seen, and you enter the fever district, and the pestilence increases as you approach the shore. And this medical knowledge that at elevation you could avoid the disease is more widespread than Mexico. Other physicians at the time talked about this relationship. The Inspector General of the Navy and three-time president of the French Academy of Sciences of the French Navy, Henri-Louis Duhamel de Monceau, had written in 1759 that the bitter experience in Saint-Domingue demonstrated that when you were in tropical climates, you had to stay at high ground to avoid the fever. His warning was repeated for the British audience a few years later by other scholars, Donald Munro in particular, physicians, in his widely read essay of the means of preserving the health of soldiers, and by other authors writing in both French and English afterwards. So the third time that Veracruz is heroic, the story is different because the invaders are actually successful. The U.S. Army's first wartime experience with yellow fever occurred during the Mexican-American War from 1846 to 47, and the initial invasion from Texas wasn't really getting them to Mexico City. They could not get to Mexico City from the north. And determined to force the turn, the Polk administration ordered a second invasion, and this one to strike from the Gulf of Mexico and take Mexico City. And Major General Winfield Scott was charged with planning and leading this attack. The threat of yellow fever was his foremost consideration. He had told his superiors when he was planning this attack that to reach the heart of the country, he said, from the Gulf Coast, there is a difficulty in three quarters of the year more formidable than the artificial defenses of other countries, and I allude to the vomito. His entire campaign hinged on avoiding the disease. The city would have to be taken quickly, he warned, and it had to be done in March before the season started at the latest. And failing to do so, he said, by running into the season of the vomito might quadruple the waste of life and cause the invading army to lose a campaign. And so he planned to do this with about 15,000 troops fully supplied that would get to Veracruz and quickly head up the road to Jalapa to Mexico City with all the supplies they needed to get there. But because he wants to do it before the yellow fever season, he can't get everything he wants. And he only gets about 8,600 troops to land in Veracruz. They take the city, and by the end of the month, head inland in accordance to his plan. But because he did not have enough time to get this strategy complete, he needed reinforcements and he needed supplies. So he needed to keep the line open to the city and to the port. In the end, Scott's plan succeeded because he gets to take his army out and west uphill towards Mexico City, but for those who stay behind to maintain the line of supplies and those who are part of the home squadron sent to support him and blockade the coast suffer immensely. He's able to get his army to Mexico City, force their demands, but the fate of these soldiers further demonstrates that the U.S. Army of the importance of keeping troops outside of urban areas that are susceptible to disease and uphill. So after this success, other U.S. incursions in the tropics follow the same plan. Avoid the city, stay at high ground. And I saw this again in my work when the U.S. intervenes in Cuba. They talk about when to do it because of the season and how to get Santiago and out of Santiago quickly. So I'm left with a bunch of questions with this research at this moment. If they know, since the second half of the 1700s, that if you get to high elevation, you avoid fever, why don't they appropriate and use this knowledge in these military strategies? In the case of the Spanish, at the end of the Mexican War, well, their hand is forced. They're doing the obvious thing. They're staying at the fort where they can actually do the most damage with the few troops that they have. And the Mexicans use this knowledge against the French when Santa Anna decides, I'm just going to stay out of Veracruz and let the French suffer the consequences of disease and not fight them. But the French have experience with this. Why is Scott the only invader to use the medical knowledge and no one else? And he famously traveled with his library, so I got a hold of the listings of his libraries when it got donated, and it includes Humboldt, so he travels with Humboldt, and it's a well-read copy. And we know that the U.S. incorporation of this medical knowledge had tremendous historical ramifications for the region. Mexico lost the entire north half of the country. And then the Americans are able to use this knowledge as well in order to get Cuba establishing itself as the dominant imperial power in their region. So looking at yellow fever, and not just the way in which the disease changes history or is a historical actor, but also in the ways in which people understand how the disease behaves, is an important way of seeing how interactions in the Caribbean and the United States in the Caribbean is able to establish its power. And I'll leave it there because I'm out of time. Thank you.